All right, 1 Samuel chapter 3. I know I said this probably the last two lessons. I do this study, and I get so excited about this. I just can't wait to come in here and teach this. I hope it comes across. There's some just neat stuff in here. This is just fun stuff, neat stuff. But where review? You know, Samuel begins in the time of the judges, of course, when Israel is sunk low in sin and apostasy. Now, God has graciously answered the prayers of Hannah. Remember, we saw the whole story. A godly but childless woman. So God gave her a son. She names him Samuel. And she dedicates him to the Lord's service for the rest of his life. So Samuel, at about the age of 3, is given to Eli at the tabernacle. It says several times how the boy ministered to the Lord before Eli the priest. He was raised in the tabernacle. He is the deliverer God is sending to Israel. We'll see that a little bit more tonight. Now, we saw last week in chapter 2 that an unnamed prophet walks into the tabernacle, up to the tabernacle, and delivers a message from the Lord to Eli about his family. I have it broken down there on your sheet. Won't go through the whole thing in detail. Verse 31, he tells Eli, the house of Eli's arm is going to be broken, meaning your strength. The glory and strength of the house of Eli is going to be cut off because of what they've done. Verse 31, 32, and also verse 33, he tells them, from now on, there will not be an old man in your house. All of your family from now on are going to die before they get old. From some tragedy, from something or other, they're going to die. Verse 33 says, they're all going to die in the prime of life. They're going to be cut down, the word is. He tells them, I won't wipe out your entire family. I'll save a remnant. In fact, in 1 Samuel 22, when Saul later on will kill almost everyone in Eli's house except for one man, Abimelech, he'll save one man alive. This is a couple years down the road, but it's coming because of God's judgment. Verse 34, this prophet told him, both of your sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will die in the same day. In verse 36, he tells him, Eli's family will be reduced to begging. God is very mad at the house of Eli because of what's been going on. Verse 32, we saw last week, is an amazing prophecy. God, this prophet told this Eli, you will see the distress of my dwelling. Remember, my dwelling is a tabernacle. You're going to see the tabernacle in distress. We'll see that tonight. And then he said that deep prophecy we saw last week, verse 35, where God says, I will raise up for myself a faithful priest and an enduring house. Now, of course, that's fulfilled in Samuel immediately. Later on down the road, under David and Solomon, the household of Zadok is chosen to be priests. They were much better priests than Eli was. But of course, you know that's talking about Christ, ultimately. It's pointing ahead to Christ. God himself will raise up a faithful priest and an enduring household. We saw that last week. Now, the reasons for this judgment, just so you know what's going on, look at chapter 2, verse 29. We saw this last week. The reason this prophet, God gave this prophet this message is, look at chapter 2, verse 29. This prophet said, Eli, why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering, which I've commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choices of every offering of my people Israel? Notice chapter 3, verse 13. It says, for I have told him that I'm about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli, the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. Remember what the sons were doing. They were robbing the sacrifices. They were robbing the people of God by force, making themselves fat and rich off things they had no right to, dishonoring God. God uses the word here, blaspheming. And also they're bringing immorality into the tabernacle. They were having immorality with the women there who served at the tabernacle. Right?
And Eli turned a
blind eye. That's what it says here, because you refused. You did not suppress your sons. He should have stopped them long ago for this. And he didn't. He didn't do it. He tried a little bit in chapter 2. We saw he said something to them, but by that time he was so old they kind of just laughed him off. They wouldn't even listen to him. So God has determined that they're all going to, the whole family is going to be judged. Now let's move on to where we are today. God raised it. Look at chapter 3. Let's just read the first 14 verses. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. It happened at that time as Eli was lying down in his place. Now his eyesight had begun to grow dim, and he could not see well, and the lamp of God had not yet gone out. Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was.
But the Lord called Samuel. He said, "Here I am." Then he ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call. Lie down again." So he went and lay down. The Lord called yet again, "Samuel." So Samuel arose, went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he answered, "I did not call my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor had the word of the Lord yet been revealed to him. That's probably why he doesn't know what's going on here. It's been so long since they've heard a prophet. Verse 8, so the Lord called Samuel again the third time. And he rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down, and it shall be, if he calls you, that you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Then the Lord came and stood and called at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." The Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which both the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle. And that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I'm about to judge his house forever for iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves. He did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." Now Josephus says Samuel was 12 years old. We don't know that's true, but that's probably about right. By the way, the timing goes here. He's probably in that age. He's old enough now to start a ministry. He's a young man. He's a 12-year-old probably. Now it says here in verse 1, note it again. It says, "Word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. From the time of Joshua until this, there's only been three prophets. There was Deborah, who was an unnamed prophet in the book of Joshua, and this prophet here in chapter 2. Very rare. Of course, the reason for that, as God says, is because of their wickedness. When Israel fell into wickedness and rebellion, God stopped talking to them. God stopped sending prophets. God stopped sending visions. So it's been a long time since anyone's heard a word from the Lord. Now, this prophet just showed up. As far as what's going on here, no one even knows what's going on. It hasn't been so long. And he stopped speaking because they were so rebellious. Now Eli, we're told in verse 2, is old and his eyesight dim. In verse chapter 4, we'll see he's 95. People back in those days, they didn't normally live that old. He's an old man. Now notice in verse 3, they're both sleeping in the tabernacle. Now that's unusual. Before this, in the old days, no one would sleep in the tabernacle. It wasn't a place, there wasn't a house. But again, there's so much goes on here that demonstrates they've forgotten a whole lot of the ways of the Lord. We'll see some of that again tonight. That they're living in the tabernacle. And little Samuel, 12-year-old, is sleeping in the tabernacle. But note what the author here points out. Probably Samuel's writing is verse 3. Where the ark of the Lord was. They're sleeping in the holy place. Not the most holy place. In the holy place. Where the ark of the Lord was. Now Samuel's sleeping somewhere near that little curtain. That if you open that curtain, right in there is the ark of the Lord. I gave you this sheet so you can picture this. We're going to see a whole lot of this thing tonight. Where the ark of the Lord was. Again, they aren't supposed to probably be doing this, but it's been a long time. People have forgotten a lot of things. In verses 4 through 10, God calls Samuel four times. I was almost certainly speaking from the mercy seat. Remember what the mercy seat was? On top of this tabernacle, on top of this ark. This is called the mercy seat, where God would meet with them. This is where the Shekinah glory would shine. This is where the priest once a year would come in with blood and sprinkle on the mercy seat. That's where God says, "I will meet with you." Now remember, this box isn't God. God's not in this box. But he determined, I will meet with you here. I will be here when you come in. I will display my glory here. It's a special thing. Now, four times he calls Samuel. The first three times, of course, Samuel runs to Eli. I imagine Eli's probably getting pretty annoyed, this kid waking him up three times in the middle of the night, especially when you're an old man. Probably to shake him, "Get up, Eli, did you call me?" "No, I'm not calling you, go back to bed." Probably something like that. But around the third time, Eli figures it out. It's the Lord calling you, not me. You're hearing a voice. Now, Eli is in the tabernacle too, but he doesn't hear any of this. He doesn't see any of this, but he's there. So Eli wisely says to him, when this happens again, you say, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." I read a whole bunch of stuff this week on just that phrase alone. That's a very wise phrase. We should all think about that. This should be our attitude whenever we hear God's word. "Speak, Lord. Your servant is hearing." A.W. Tozer wrote a book years ago. I forget what the title was. One of the chapters was called "God Tells the Man Who Cares." Remember he said in there, a lot of Christians complain, "Well, God never speaks to me. God isn't leading me. I feel like God is not really working in my life." He said, that may be because God knows if he did move in your life, you wouldn't listen anyway. But if God knows you care, if you tell God, Lord, your servant hears and I will listen to whatever you say. He said, God will lead you through the scriptures. God will guide you. The Holy Spirit will work in you. Remember Jesus said, those who are faithful in little are given much. But if you're not faithful in little, why should he give you more? Speak, Lord, your servant hears. When you come into church on a Sunday or tonight, you got to know it to be, Lord, speak. I'm here to hear you, Lord. Speak to me. You know, when you read your Bibles, when you hear Bible in the cars, Lord, speak to me. I'm listening, Lord. I'm here. I'm listening. You know, you ask the question, why should God tell me anything if I'm not going to do what he says? Why would he? But here he says, speak, Lord. Talk to me. Your spirit, your servant is listening. So the fourth time, notice it says there, the first three times God called him. The fourth time it said, literally, Yahweh stood before him. And we don't know how this looks, but God himself stood before him. This is one of those pre-incarnate visions of Christ, I believe. But he made a stand right in front of little Eli, or little Samuel, I mean, 12-year-old Samuel. That's how old he is. And he speaks to him. Notice when Samuel repeats, he doesn't say, speak, Lord. He knows what this is. Speak, I'm listening. Speak, I'm here to hear you. Tell me what you have to say to me. And then what God does here is God reveals to this brand new prophet, Hannah's son is now a prophet. God reveals to Samuel what he's about to do. And we read that already. And notice he says there, what God says there, verse 11, I'm going to do something in Israel that everyone who hears it, their ears are going to tingle. You ever hear that phrase, I can't believe my ears? You hear something so incredible, I can't believe I heard that. God says, I'm about to do something in Israel that everyone who hears about this is going to go, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. It's pretty incredible stuff. God's going to shake Israel to its core, and also the Philistines as well. God's going to do something pretty spectacular here in a minute to show who he is. Hebrews 1:1 says, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. Samuel is now a prophet. God has revealed himself to Samuel. Samuel knew who Yahweh was. He's raised in the tabernacle by Eli. But now God himself has appeared to him and spoken to him. So drop down now to verse 19. This is a summary of this whole thing. And it's very important. Verse 19. Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. I get that. Samuel's getting older. But it says God is with him, and none of his words fail. It's a mark of a true prophet. Samuel is a true prophet of the Lord, and none of his word fails. Everything God speaks through Samuel comes to pass exactly as that's always a test of a true prophet. Deuteronomy 18 says that. If a prophet speaks in my name, and what he says doesn't come to pass, he's no prophet of mine. Which, in my mind, eliminates almost everyone today who claims to be a prophet. But Samuel was a prophet, and what he says happens. Notice again what it says here, verse 20. It says, verse 20, all Israel from Dan even to Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. The word gets out. All of Israel. Dan is the northernmost part of Israel. Beersheba is way down in the south, meaning the whole nation heard. Word got out. Guess what? God has raised up a prophet. God spoke to Samuel. That's big news. They've got a prophet again. They've got someone to lead them. Eli probably had no message from the Lord for a long, long time, if ever. We're not told Eli had any message from the Lord. God spoke to Samuel. Quite a few things. And notice the last verse. The Lord appeared again at Shiloh because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. It's like they're so excited. Guess what? In Shiloh now, God is now speaking again. It's been years since God has spoken to Israel. Now they're all saying from Dan to Beersheba, but at Shiloh, where the tabernacle is, God is speaking to his prophet Samuel. Neat stuff. They're very excited about this. They recognize that Samuel is a true prophet. A new spiritual leader has arisen, and God is with him. That's a neat thought. Now in the middle of all this, let's go back to verse 15. So Samuel lay down until morning. I don't know how well he slept the rest of that night. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord. But Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. Then Eli called Samuel and said, Samuel, my son. And he said, here I am. He said, what is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you. So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, "It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him." How do you like that response? Is that a good response?
Yes.
He's basically saying, well, it's God, whatever.
You don't. Or
he could have been a little more excited about
it. He was already told.
Yeah, but you don't see, you would like to see Eli say, cry out to the Lord. Please, Lord, no. Please, Lord, forgive me. Please, Lord, have mercy. Please, Lord. He kind of just says, well, God's going to do what God's going to do. That's kind of what he says here.
Sort of reminds me.
I mean, of course, Eli at this time may be way too old even to do anything about his sons. He's probably in his 90s. He's probably, it says there he can't see anymore. He's blind. What's he going to do? How's he going to stop his sons now? It's way past the time to do something right. Now chapter 4. Let's pick up the story. Let's just read the first 4 verses. Thus the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer while the Philistines camped in Aphek. The Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men in the battlefield. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, that it may come along with us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who sits above the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. Notice it says they went out to meet. In other words, the Philistines are attacking Israel. They go out to meet them on the battlefield. And of course, 4,000 men get slaughtered. They lose this battle. Now, this may be at Samuel's word. We don't know that. Chapter verse 1 mentions Samuel. For the whole rest of this part of the story, Samuel's not involved. He's not mentioned here at all. Now, the Philistines were a large nation. They're descended from Shem, Noah's sons. That's Genesis 10:14. Ethnically, they're Egyptian. They're very much related to the Egyptians. They settled in Canaan before Abraham, and they've been there a long time, and they adopted the religion of the Canaanites, which tells you a lot about them. They're pagans. They have all this terrible worship. The Canaanite religion is just sick. We'll see more of that as we go through the study of Samuel. At this point, the Philistines have been at war with Israel for about 20 years, and they will be for 20 more years. In fact, David's the one who actually finally defeats the Philistines and puts them into subjection. But Judges 13:1 says that for 40 years the Philistines attacked Israel. This is right in the middle. It's about 20 years into that time. The Philistines just every now and then just decide to attack Israel, try to wipe them out, try to take their land. It's been going on for a long time. The Philistines actually is where we get the word Palestine from, Palestinian. Many of the Palestinians, they think, are descended from the Philistines, and they're still giving Israel trouble. Keep your finger here and turn to Psalm 78. Psalm 78 speaks of this time. As I said, this study, a lot of this study is going to tie in with the Psalms as well. A lot of the Psalms talks about these days. Psalm 78. Starting at verse 56. Psalm 78, verse 56. Long psalm. It's basically giving a lot of history of Israel. 56, speaking of Israel. "Yet they tempted and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned back and acted treacherously like their fathers. They turned aside like a treacherous bow, for they provoked him with their high places," meaning their horrible idolatry, "and aroused his jealousy with their graven images. When God heard, he was filled with wrath and greatly abhorred Israel." No, so he abandoned the dwelling place at Shiloh. This is going to happen in chapter 4. "The tent which he had pitched among men, and gave up his strength to captivity and his glory into the hand of the adversary. He also delivered his people with the sword and was filled with wrath at his inheritance." We have to stop there. But notice, God is so angry with Israel at this period in time because of what they're doing, because of their apostasy, the wickedness of the house of Eli. The people in general have forgotten about God. This dumb stunt they just pulled here shows they have a very low view of God. And God says how I gave them up and I gave up my place. I gave up Shiloh. This is going to be destroyed here shortly. So now, Israel goes out to meet the Philistines, and they have a terrible slaughter. They're wiped out, 4,000 men. They're dismayed. They're badly defeated. And so they get this arrogant idea. Let's go back to Shiloh and bring the Ark of the Covenant out to the battlefield with us. Now, that's been done before. Joshua did this. God told him. Remember when they marched around Jericho, take the Ark with you on the seventh day? David's going to do this later and be blessed for it. But what they're doing here is wrong. What they're doing here is a bad attitude. And the author here points that out to us. Note that phrase there, verse 3. Let's take to ourselves the ark. Let's grab the ark for ourselves. Let's just take it and use it. Let's take the ark.
They're using it like a good luck charm.
Exactly. They don't inquire of the Lord. They don't ask Samuel. They don't seek the Lord's face. They just take it. In fact, the author here is pointing out to us what they're doing. And notice it again there, verse 3. In the middle of the verse. Let us take to ourselves from Shiloh. Notice how it says, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Now, he could have just said the ark. The ark of the covenant of the Lord. The ark of the covenant of Yahweh. All Yahweh's covenant promises centered around this ark. I will meet with you here. I will atone for your sins here. You will be my nation if you come to me and make atonement here at this spot. He calls it the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And notice verse 4, what the author calls it. In the middle of the verse, he says, they carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of hosts who sits above the cherubim. You get what he's trying to do there? This is the most sacred object on earth. It is at this time. The most sacred thing on earth. This is where the God of hosts, the God of the armies of heaven, sits below the cherubim. This is the most sacred object on earth. It's holy to the Lord. Remember, God's not in this box. It's not, this box isn't God, but God has set this box aside to be the place where he would meet in mercy and judgment on Israel. Let's just go grab it and bring it out to the battlefield. Maybe it'll help us. That's a bad attitude they're showing here. And the author here, I think, is trying to tell us how important this ark is that they're treating so normally, so secularly. So the author reminds us of what's really going on here and what the Israelites were not fully considering. And notice, as Paul said, they're treating the ark like a good luck charm, like a magic thing. If we have this ark with us, surely we're going to win this battle, like a magic object, a pagan object. And as Dean just pointed out, accompanying the ark are who? Hophni and Phinehas. God has already pronounced their doom. He's already rejected them totally. These are wicked, blasphemous, evil men. So see what's going on there. You know where this is going to go. Where it's going to end up. One of the commentators says, this is a crassly pagan attitude. Pagans did this stuff. They carried the symbols of their God with them in the battle, thinking that would give them good luck on the battlefield. That's what they're doing here. And this is going to end up very bad. The holiest object on earth. And so let's read verses 5 through 9 of chapter 4. As the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout that the earth resounded. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, what does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean? Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. You would think that would be enough. But God is determining to judge Israel. So note the very next verse. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent, and the slaughter was very great. For there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. When the ark gets into the camp and all the soldiers see it, they shout this big shout. Now, I don't know how genuine that was. Probably was. It shook the earth. Remember back in Joshua, they were told it. When they marched around the city the seventh time, there was a shout, and then the walls fell down. They're probably doing something like that. The Philistines hear this great shout and send some spies out. What's going on? And they see that the Ark of the Covenant is probably right in the middle of the camp, right where all the campfires are. They've brought their God into the battlefield, and the Philistines are terrified. It says it twice. They're terrified. Woe to us. Why? Well, they've heard what God did to the Egyptians. That was only 90 years ago at this time. Imagine. If that happened today, that was back in the 1930s. not that long ago, that God destroyed. They heard this. That spread throughout the whole region. Remember, God said to them, I'll send the terror of you on ahead of you. All the nations knew what the God of Israel did. In fact, Egypt's still recovering from that. It took him a long time to become a world power again. God wiped out Egypt. He destroyed them. They heard this. They know what's happened. And now they're saying, oh no, they brought their God into their camp with them. What are we going to do? We're going to die. You would think they'd surrender. You would think they'd flee. What do they do? We're going to fight anyway. Be men. I believe that's God's judgment. God is determined Israel needs to be punished. So did the Philistines. That's coming as well. God is determined to punish them. This is God working here. God's going to punish them. But they know what happened to Egypt. Then verse 10 and 11 says, Israel suffers a terrible slaughter. Terrible slaughter again. Men are so slow. Zephaniah says they ran away. They run back to their tents. They run home. They just quit the fight and run home. Run for their lives. Terrible slaughter. Hophni and Phinehas die as the prophet said they would. And the ark is captured. Now get that. Dean?
There's another reason for their ears to tingle.
Yeah, the ark is captured. I mean, they've been defeated before by the Philistines. They fought before. In this chapter, five times you read the phrase, the ark was captured. That's the point of this. Can you believe it? The ark is captured. That hasn't happened since, it's never happened. From the day that Moses was given the plans for the ark was protected by Israel, surrounded by Israel. Now the Philistines have it. They've captured the ark of God. You've got to try to figure out how that would sound to the Israelites. How would you hear that? That's an awful thing. We've captured their God. And of course, the Philistines are thinking, we've taken their God. We've defeated their God. Terrible slaughter. Of course, Shiloh this time is also destroyed. It's gone. It's not used again for the tabernacle. In fact, I've read this week that the ruins of Shiloh have been found by archaeologists. There was a settlement there. They know right where it was. There's very much evidence of several battles fought there. Look at verse 14 to 22. Now of chapter 4. Go back to verse 12. I'll give you some out. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. When he came, behold, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road eagerly watching because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. So the man came to tell it in the city and all the city cried out. This guy comes into town and tells them how badly they were defeated. The whole town starts wailing and moaning. Eli, who's outside out of town at the tabernacle, hears this. So now verse 14. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, what does the noise of this commotion mean? Then the man came hurriedly and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old. His eyes were set so that he could not see. The man said, Eli, I'm the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I have escaped from the battle line today. And he said, how did things go, my son? Then the one who brought the news replied, Israel has fled before the Philistines. There's been a great slaughter among the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the ark of God has been taken. When he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell off the seat backwards beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for he was old and heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. Notice Eli doesn't get that excited when his sons are dead. He hears the news, both your boys are dead. He knew that was coming. He didn't know the ark was going to be taken. And that news so upsets him. He goes backwards. He's so fat and heavy and old, he falls back and breaks his neck and dies. But he ruled Israel, not ruled, but he judged Israel for 40 years, it says. 19. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was taken, that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the woman who stood by her said to her, do not be afraid, you're giving birth to a son. But she did not answer or pay attention. And she called the boy Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel because the ark of God was taken and because of her father-in-law and her husband. She said, the glory has departed from Israel for the ark of God was taken. There's a sign given. Of course, Eli dies, but his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, is pregnant. And she's the time for birth has come, and all this excitement, she goes into labor. She dies in childbirth. Many, many people did back then. She dies in childbirth. But as she's dying, instead of rejoicing over having a son, she names his son Ichabod, which means the glory has departed. The ark is gone. But this is a sign that the author here records for Israel. She named this son Ichabod. The glory has left. I read a story this week. Martin Lloyd-Jones has a real big famous church in London, which I guess he dedicated. Oh, that's okay. And he told them, this church must always preach the gospel. This church must always be centered on scripture. He said, if not, I'm personally going to come by here and write Ichabod across the door. Years and years and years later, after Martin Lloyd-Jones was dead, the church has gone strongly liberal. Someone painted Ichabod across the front of the church. Of course, that's graffiti, that's vandalism, but it's true. I'm sure many of these churches in the area, you could paint Ichabod across the door. The glory has departed. They don't preach the gospel anymore. They don't preach Christ. Israel has lost the presence of God. The glory has departed. Now, let's get to the exciting stuff, chapter 5. Yeah. I call this Philistine archaeology. That's a pun, I get it. You can groan if you want. Let's just walk through this. Now remember, ancient cultures believed that their gods followed them onto the battlefield. And that a victory was considered that your gods have beat their gods. That's how they saw it. That one god was defeating another. Now the ark, remember, is not God. It's just a box, which he told them to make. Nor is he in it. But he chose to manifest himself in this ark. This is the most holiest object on earth. The Philistines have won it in battle. Let's look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 5. We'll go through this verse by verse. Now the Philistines, I gave you a map, by the way, to follow how this is going if you want to. Now the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. That's about 30 miles. They take it deep into Philistine territory. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. Let's stop there. They considered Israel's God to be defeated because they took the Ark of the Covenant. And they brought the Ark 30 miles to Ashdod. That's deep into Philistine territory, out by the coastline, far away from Israel. And they brought it into one of the main temples of their god, Dagon. Now, Dagon was considered to be the father of the Baals. It tells you a lot about Dagon. He was a fish god, head of a man, but bottom half of a fish. The fish god, they called him, half man, half fish. He was the god of fertility, which tells you a whole lot about how they worshipped him. Won't go into details there. And the god of harvest. That's important. Think about that. He's the god of the harvest. It says, notice it says there, they took the Ark of God, and it says they set it before Dagon. And those words mean Dagon tried this big 8 or 9, 10 foot statue in this some kind of temple. They set the Ark of the Covenant right in front of him like a treasure. Look, we brought you, Dagon, the defeated Hebrew god, as if it's some kind of a tribute to Dagon, their god. They're using it as an act of worship. This implies it's a special place. This is implying like an offering to Dagon. Their God we offer to you now, Dagon, O great one. But they're very deep now in Philistine territory. And set it means they implied a special like of worship. We're worshiping Dagon by offering to him the Ark of the Covenant. The Hebrew God has been defeated. Now, I remember when I was first saved, I read through the New Testament. Then I got my mom's King James Bible and read through. I remember when I first came to this story, I couldn't put it down. Because you know, if you never heard this story before, you think, what do you think is going to happen next? The God of heaven and earth is set before this pagan statue. What do you think is going to happen next? Of course, you know. I remember when I first read this as a kid, this was so exciting. It still is. This is a fascinating story. So now it's verse 3. When the Ashdodites arose early next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place again. Just think about this. It says Dagon had fallen on his face. Now this statue is probably about 8 feet tall. It's a big thing. They found some of these, about pieces of these. They've seen drawings of them. Next morning they come into the temple of Dagon and he's on his face on the ground before the ark of the covenant. How do you think that happened? Seriously, how do you think that happened?
Angels.
God. I would bet some angel walked in there and get down. Bang. He was fastened down. Something that big. He's probably out of bronze, maybe covered with gold or silver. Don't know. Get down. And threw him right in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Imagine what they thought when they walked in there. Think about it. It's an amazing thought when you think about it. Before Dagon. In fact, notice what it says there. In fact, this is probably meant to be mocking us. It says there how they set him in his place again.
Yeah. I've always laughed at that. They had to do it.
Yeah, three or four guys had to grab this thing, stand it back up, and nail it down again. Think about that. How stupid can this be? I understand there, Isaiah 40, he didn't turn here, but in Isaiah 40, many times God, but especially in Isaiah 40, he's mocking the heathen for their pagan practice. And he says, you take a piece of wood, you cut it in half. With one half you heat your house with and cook your food. With the other half you make an idol, you paint it, you stand it up, you nail it down so it won't fall over. What God is saying is, how stupid can you be? And then you worship it. You worship this thing you just made. They had to set Dagon back up on his feet. Think about it. I love that picture. God has a sense of humor. It's going to get worse, but God has a sense of humor. So look at verse 4. But when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were, notice, cut off, not broken off, cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Now think about this. The next day, Dagon is again fallen over right in front of the ark, but his head is cut off, not broken off, cut. His hands are cut off. And where are they? Where is his head and hands? On the threshold. So think about it. These Dagonian priests get up that morning, pull back the curtain, and what do they see? There's his head and hands. They had to step over Dagon's head and hands to get into his own temple. And they're not broken off. They're cut off. Again, how do you think that happened? I'm sure some angel of the Lord that attends this ark just said, no way. Get down and rip this guy apart. Think of what message would that send to these Philistines? Think what God is saying here.
I'm cutting you off.
Exactly. Remember what he told Eli? I'm going to cut off your hands. That's the word here. I'm going to cut off your strength. You have no strength. In this temple, you have no strength in front of the Ark of the Covenant. In front of the Hebrew God, you are powerless. Of course, he doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
So picture that. I love the picture of that. Imagine a priest walking in there and they had a... In fact, we're told there, look at verse 5. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. This started a brand new ritual. This was enshrined now in their ritual. From now on, whenever a Dagon priest enters the house of Dagon, he will not step on the threshold. He will step over it. Forever reminding them what God did here. And there's a verse after your sheet there from Zephaniah, which is hundreds of years later. Zephaniah 1:9 says, on that day I will punish everyone who leaps over the threshold. He's referring to the Philistines. This became their practice for the rest of their life. When they entered the house of Dagon, they would not step upon the threshold. Why? Because of this. It's interesting how God immortalized this whole thing. But now know what happens next. And this is amazing. Verse 6. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God. God breaks out in plague on this whole region. Tumors, it says here, plague. Notice that the hand of the Lord was heavy. Now that's a pun. Remember what happened to Dagon? What happened to his hands? But Yahweh's hand was heavy on this whole region. Yahweh's wrath was traveling through this whole area. I'll show you who God really is, what God's saying here. Dagon is handless. Dagon is headless, but I'll show you who God really is. And God brings out this head. He says they were ravaged. Ravaged. That's a serious word in the Hebrew. That means ripped apart. This plague was so severe, it ripped them apart. Smote with tumors. And notice they say themselves, his hand, Yahweh's hand is severe on us and Dagon our God. They saw Dagon ripped to pieces. And now they're being ripped to pieces by this plague that broke out. And again, that's a play on words, I believe. His hands are heavy. Unlike Dagon, who has no hands anymore, God's hand was very heavy on them. So what do? Let's send it to the next town over. Let's get it out of here. Verse 8 and 9. So they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they said, let the ark of God of Israel be brought around to Gath. And they brought the ark of the God of Israel around. And after they had brought it around, The hand of the Lord was against the city with a very great confusion, and he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. Okay, if you follow your map, this thing's moving around quite a bit. City to city. There's five great cities in the Philistine territory. This thing starts ravaging all of them. They go to Gath now with this thing. I'm sorry, Notice they send the Gath. It's the same plague breaks out. They have very great confusion. We're in the middle of a pandemic. At least so they tell us. A very mild pandemic. But you see how people panic now? Today, people are panicking. You hear about a nursing home gets sick and everybody gets panicked, and now the world panicked over it. Can you imagine a real plague like this? Surely they heard what happened back in where they just were. And now it's come to their city, and now they're dying, and now they're getting these tumors and these plagues. So there's very much confusion. People just are panicking. People are panicked over these, as well they should be. So what do? They send it around again, verse 10. So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. And as the Ark of God came to Ekron, the Ekronites cried out, "They have brought the Ark of the God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people." Note this next verse. They sent therefore and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the Ark of God to Israel. Let it return to its own place, and it will not kill us and our people." For there was deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. Notice this verse. The men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. Everybody is sick. Many are dying from these tumors, whatever it is. But everybody's sick. Those who aren't dead have tumors. Imagine that. It's plague. Plague is broken out. Serious plague. Every place the ark goes, plague and death follow. Now this plague also involves mice. Chapter 6, verse 5 mentions the mice who ravaged the fields. It says that they ravaged the fields. Remember now, Dagon is the god of harvest. This is happening at harvest time. If you notice chapter 6, verse 13. The people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat. It's harvest time. What God does here, because he's God, he calls the field mice out of all the fields. Millions of them, probably, answer his command. He commands the end. He speaks to the end. They do his will. Either he creates them or he calls them. He brings in thousands of these field mice into the fields. They're ravaging, that's the word used here, ravaging the crops and probably bringing disease. Some think this is bubonic plague. Some think the word here is very similar to hemorrhoids. I don't know if that's true. That could be very serious. But they're dying from it. They have tumors on their bodies. They're dying from this plague. God is commanding the mice. God is commanding the plague. Serious stuff. I have a verse here from Habakkuk 3:5. Habakkuk cries out to God to save them from their enemies. Anyway, in 3:5, he's describing the God of Israel coming from Egypt, coming to rescue his people. And one verse he says is Habakkuk 3:5. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. You ever get a picture of God like that? Like dogs, like trained dogs at his feet. As he's coming, in front of him goes pestilence. Behind him comes plague. God is the God of plague and disease and pestilence when he wants to be. He controls all these things. And God will destroy people with these very things. That's our God. He controls the microbes. He controls the germs and the virus. He controls the mice. He controls all this stuff. We see in a minute he even talks to cows. He controls all of this. And every place this ark goes throughout the land of the Philistines, there people are dying probably by the thousands. Crying out in terror. Notice as they cry out to heaven. They're even praying to their God, but getting no help at all. Dagon can't help them at all right now. That's the point, isn't it? When God does stuff like this. Look at the panic. It's amazing stuff. And the God of Israel here is far from defeated. Who captured who? They thought they captured the God of Israel. Who really captured who? Remember, the God of Israel, he prophesied this, that this would happen before it happened. God had planned this. God is actually orchestrating this. Not only to teach the Philistines who he really is, but to teach his own people back home. They're hearing all of this. They know what's going on here. Now, chapter 6. After 7 months of this, get that, 7 months of this, the Philistines finally start to wise up. I think what's involved, and we'll see here in chapter 6, because their magic men, their priests, warned their leaders, don't be stubborn like Pharaoh was. I think they don't want to give this back because they would admit defeat.
Yes.
They don't want to admit that they were wrong, that the God of Israel is truly God. Their God, Dagon, can't do a thing about this. They're being stubborn. And the priests warn them, don't be like the Pharaohs. We'll get to that in a minute. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's read verses 1 through 9, chapter 6. Now the ark of the Lord had been in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and a diviner, this is their holy men, saying, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place. They said, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but you shall surely return to him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. Then they said, what shall be the guilt offering which we shall return to him? And they said, 5 golden tumors. And 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for one plague was in all of you and all your lords. There are 5 lords of the Philistines. In fact, if you look at chapter verse 17, it mentions these 5 cities, these 5 rulers. But picture this. I'm getting ahead of myself. When this ark finally shows up back in Israel, they don't know it's coming. There's the Ark of the Covenant. And there's this box. And what's in the box? Golden tumors. And little golden mice. What's up with that? You would wonder, wouldn't you? This is almost funny. They had this box, 5 golden tumors. But they say to him, look. In fact, I left out verse 6. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? When he had severely dealt with them, did they not allow the people to go and they departed? In other words, don't be like Pharaoh was. This is only 90 years ago. If this is 20, this is back in the 1930s this happened. Not that long ago. It's in recent history. They knew what God did to Pharaoh. And they're saying, look, don't be stupid like he was. He hardened his heart and what happened? More plagues, worse plagues. It got worse and worse and worse and worse. So finally Egypt was wiped out. These diviners, he's having enough sense to tell their leaders, stop being so proud. Stop being so arrogant. Send this thing back and do it right now. Otherwise, we're going to end up like Egypt did. We're all going to die. It's a serious... At least they have that much faith. They know that much. So they're reluctant to give it up. They're too proud and stubborn. But they do decide to send it back. Notice it says with a guilt offering. They're making an apology. Their priests and their diviners, these have this right. Don't just send it back empty. He's mad at us. Send back some kind of an offering. So they make up these little gold tumors and gold mice and send it back. It's almost funny. There's a mouse and a tumor for each of these 5 rulers, hoping God will have mercy on them. Their spiritual leaders warn not to be stubborn. They're saying, do you want any more plagues? Don't be so proud. Now, they propose this test. And you can see in this test that these rulers want this test to fail. They don't want the people of Philistia, knowing that it was the God of Israel who did this. They set this test up so it would fail and fail miserably. Let's read through this. Verse 7 and following. Now therefore, take and prepare a new cart and 2 milch cows on which there has never been a yoke, and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. Take the ark of the Lord, place it on the cart, put the articles of gold which you return to him as a guilt offering in a box by its side, then send it away that it may go. And here's the test. Watch. If it goes up by the way of its own territory to Beth Shemesh, then he has done to us this great evil. But if not, then we will know it has not his hand has struck us. It happened to us by chance. They don't want the people acknowledging that Yahweh did this, the God of Israel. So they set this test up, but they set up the odds so it can't happen. They say this, look, we're going to put this thing on a cart with 2 cows. If it goes straight back to Israel, then we'll know God did it. But if these 2 cows just get lost in the field or don't get it there, then we'll know it's just by chance. It wasn't God. And look at how they set this up. This is kind of funny. They put it on a brand new cart. In other words, this cart was never used for anything else that might upset the God of Israel. It's a clean cart, never used for idolatry. It's just a very clean, brand new cart. They take 2 cows. 2 female cows that have never been trained to pull a cart. They've never had a yoke on them. Now think about that. You got to train cows to do this. You have to, I read this several times this week, you have to train a cow to bear under a yoke. to know how to listen to a yoke, to know how to work together. These are two cows that have never had a yoke on in their entire life. They've never pulled a cart. What do you think is going to happen? They're not going to work together. They're not going to even know what to do. They'll feel this thing in their shoulder and go a little crazy and turn the cart over and who knows what. Just like a horse. You can't just throw a saddle on a horse and ride. You've got to break a horse. You've got to train a horse. You can't just throw a yoke on a cow and expect them to do the work for you. You've got to train him how to do that. These cows have never had a yoke. No one's trained them, right? Notice next it says, they're milch cows. They have just given birth. Just given birth. They take their calves away from them. What's a cow? What's a mother cow going to do? Exactly. She's going to want to feed her young one. It's bred into her. It's what God has put in their cow's DNA. I want to feed my young. They're going to. And a cow, if you let a cow go without guidance, it would run immediately back to the barn or someplace to try to find its young one. Think about that. That's pretty impressive when you think about it. Milch cows have a strong urge to be with their calves. Then it says, put them on the road with nobody guiding them, no leader, no whipping, just point them towards Israel and see what they do. See what happens. Now, what are the odds that this would work? Zero. And they're hoping that's what happens. They're hoping these cows start kicking and carrying on because of this yoke they don't like. Because they're missing their young, they want to try to make a beeline back to the barn. This whole thing's going to fall apart. And because they see there, it wasn't the God of Israel. It was just chance. This is just a plague, a normal plague. And they're waiting this. They're setting this up so it fails. They do everything they can. Remember Elijah in Mount Carmel? When he's facing the prophets of Baal, what he does? Remember, they go all day long singing and dancing and cutting themselves and trying to call fire down heaven. They can't do it. Remember what Elijah does? He sets up a simple stone altar, puts a trench around it, and drowns it in water. He drowns the wood 3 times. So much so that the water rises up in this trench and everything. It's like a puddle of water with wood in it. Why'd you do that? There's no human chance fire could start on that altar. You know what happened. Look what's happening here. You know, God's orchestrating all of this. They're trying to rig the game so it looks like God didn't do this, but God's not going to have that, any of that. They're hoping these cows will wander away and come to a halt. So let's read on. Starting at verse 10. Then the men did so, took the two milch cows and hitched them to the cart. Now shut up their calves at home. Before that, the cows were probably nursing. Just took them right off these cows, shut them into a barn so they can't get out. They put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the likeness of the tumors. I still think that's funny. And notice verse 12. The cows took the straight way in the direction of Beth Shemesh. They went along the highway, lowing as they went, and did not turn aside to the right or the left, and the lords of the Philistines followed them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Beth Shemesh is in Israel. As soon as they let these cows go, beeline straight to Israel. Let's think about this. What's being picture this. This is pretty cool. This is a true demonstration of who God really is. He rules the mice. He rules the cows. God speaks to the animals, and they do whatever he says. Even against these cows' great reluctance. Notice it says they're going down the road lowing. You know what lowing here? Whoa. I read, don't quote me. I read this week, cows, when they're full of milk, they start going, and they make that noise. They're crying out to somebody. They're in distress. Come help me. These cows are doing that. They want their babies. Yet they go a straight beeline straight to Israel. They don't do anything, but they don't turn to the right. They don't turn to the left. But they're lowing the whole way. Oh, where am I? They're complaining in cow language. But they're doing exactly what God's telling them to do. It's 7 miles from where they are to Beth Shemesh. That's a long walk for cows. That's a long way to go for cows. They've never pulled a carriage. They've never worn a yoke. That ark, I don't know how heavy it is. It's probably fairly heavy. It's made of the wood that's very tight grained. It's covered in gold. The whole lid is solid gold. It's probably fairly heavy. 7 miles. It would take a while to do that. Cows don't walk for it. They're in distress, these cows. The cows are lowing all the way. They're in distress. They're complaining about this trip. But God said, go. And they go. It's probably angels guiding them. You will go straight to Israel. We won't turn to the right or the left. The cows don't even know where they've never been to Beth Shemesh. They don't know where that is. But there they go, down the road. They took the straight way, it says. protesting, lowing all the way to a place they'd never been. It says he didn't turn to the right or the left. I have a quote there from Isaiah. Well, God is, again, mocking the gods of the nations. He says this, don't you see, Isaiah 46. Bel bows down. That's one of the gods. Nebo stoops. Their idols are on beasts and lions. He's talking about how when the Babylonian captivity happens, all the gods of the nation are going to be taken captive with them. Now, he says all these idols and gods are on the back of animals being carried to Babylon. These things you carry are borne as burdens on weary beasts. They stoop, they bow down together. They cannot save the burden, but themselves go into captivity. In other words, God saying, all your idols are going to be carried on beasts of burden into Babylon. You can't do a thing about it. Yet here, the God of Israel's ark is being carried straight as an arrow, right to Israel. Straight into Israel. Now, there's more to this. Let's get even more excited. This is stuff I never knew until I actually studied into this. Look on your map there. They go to a place called Beth Shemesh. It's in Israel. What's important about Beth Shemesh? Well, it's 7 miles from Ekron. Beth Shemesh is a Levite city. Remember back in Joshua when they were dividing up the cities of Israel? The Levites were given several cities. It just so happens the Ark of the Covenant is going to a Levite city full of Levites. You remember who Levites are? They're the ones in charge of the tabernacle, in charge of God's things. But not only that, it's on your sheet there. Beth Shemesh was set aside for the clan of Kohath. Kohath's family were specifically in charge of transporting the ark. That's found in Numbers chapter 4. Coincidence? I think not. These cows who had never been here before, who don't even know how to pull a carriage, who are dying to get back to their young ones, take this ark straight to a Levite city, and not just any Levite city. There were many Levite cities. To the one where the Kohathite family lives, their specific task was to transport the ark. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. And all of this, God is saying, I'm God, and there is no other. Our God is an awesome God. He takes them right to this city in Beth Shemesh. No coincidence at all. But of course, things go bad there too, shortly. Look at verse 14. Or verse 13. Now the people of Beth Shemesh, by the way, verse 12 says how these five Philistine leaders follow this cart. And they probably can't believe it. They can't believe their eyes. This thing isn't turning to the right or the left. They follow right up to the border of Israel and see it go right into Israel. What do you think they're thinking? Uh-huh. Their God Dagon couldn't do a thing about this. The God of Israel truly must be God. I don't know if they're thinking that, but they should be thinking that. Verse 13. Now, the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. They raised their eyes and saw the ark and were glad to say, they're just out there in the fields working. All of a sudden, here comes this cart. Nobody's on it. Nobody's driving it. Just two cows lowing and carrying on like they're missing their young ones. What's on the back? The Ark of the Covenant and a box full of golden tumors. That is funny. That really is. I think it's meant to be funny. They were glad to see it. Verse 14. The cart came into the field of Joshua the Bethshemite and stood there where there was a large stone. It just stops next to this very large stone in this guy's field. They split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. Now stop there. At first thought, that sounds a wonderful thing. It's just another example of how they have forgotten the worship of God. I mean, they mean well. They take the cart, brand new wood, and cut it up and sacrifice these two cows. But you're not supposed to, it was bulls, not cows, not females. Males had to be sacrificed. They shouldn't have been. They probably don't know. This is another illustration of how they've forgotten so much of what they're supposed to know. This is what Samuel's going to do starting in chapter 7. We'll see that in a minute here. 15, the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was in it, in which were the articles of gold, and put them on the large stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices that day to the Lord. When the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned to Ekron that day. These are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned for a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both of fortified cities and the country villages. A large stone on which they set the ark of the Lord is the witness of this day in the field of Joshua. That stone's still there when this was written. Verse 19. He, that's Yahweh, struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down of all the people 50,070 men, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. The men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who's able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up from us?" So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you." It's a short story here. They offer the cows. The ark ends up in here. What they're doing is, remember, the ark is a box. This thing on top is a lid. What's inside here? Ten Commandments,
the manna,
and Joshua's rod. Is anyone allowed to look in there?
Aaron's rod.
No one's allowed to look in there. And they do. It's a terrible thing. Now, they don't know. Remember, the fact that they sacrificed these cows, they've forgotten. But God is still holy. And what's probably happening here is people are curious. There's this ark of the Lord. They're walking up and lifting the lid and looking in. It's like a tourist attraction for way too many people. They should have known better than this. And of course, God breaks out against him. Remember later, Uzzah will have the same thing happen when David's taking the ark back to Jerusalem. God is holy. And the ark ends up there. And they treat it like it's a tourist attraction. And it gets struck down. Now, let's just quickly read chapter 7, verse 1 and 2, where this ends. The men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark of the Lord. Eleazar is a Levite. From the day that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim, the time was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord for all this great slaughter that happened. 20 years later, David, King David, will take the ark from here and take it up to Jerusalem. It's an amazing story. Our God's an awesome God. I have a verse there again from Ezekiel where he says what's going on here. Ezekiel 36, this is talking about the Babylonian captivity. But God says, "I will vindicate the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, and which you have profaned among them. And the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the Lord God, and when through you I vindicate my holiness before their eyes." God is holy. He will defend his honor every place he goes. And Israel had brought shame on his name, had misused his ark, misused his holiness. And God said, "I won't have that." And he showed these Philistines who he truly was. And now he's shown Israelites who he truly is. And one more verse, chapter 7, verse 3. Here's where this goes. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, "If you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines." And verse 4 and following tells us they did that. Samuel brings Israel back to the Lord. Samuel revives Israel, a true prophet. After all of this, now the ark is back. Samuel is used by God to bring Israel back to the Lord. The next two chapters talk of that. I got your homework next time. Read for chapters 7 and 8. But what's happening here is God has spectacularly reintroduced himself to Israel. Mike?
I read that Samuel was also a judge.
Yeah. Yeah, he replaces Eli. Yeah.
Not just the prophet.
He's the last of the judges before the kings. He anoints the first king. That's when the judges end. But God has reintroduced. Remember, when Israel was in slavery 400 years, they forgot God. They were worshiping Egyptian gods. And one of the reasons God said he put on that big display of destroying Egypt was to reintroduce himself to the nation. Here's who I am. Well, here he's doing it again. After all these years, Israel's gone into just sloth and don't understand, don't know the truth anymore, don't know the word. God sends him a prophet, Samuel, to bring them back to God's truth. And God does this spectacular thing in front of them to show them who he really is. This follows right on them. When God does this, all this stuff, Israel's ready to hear Samuel. Cool stuff. Our God's an awesome God, isn't he? This is awesome stuff. This is fun stuff. I love to sit back and picture this. This is meant to be, as you read this, you're picturing this happening. God's on display. Someone said in one of the commentaries, our God's a strutting God, and he should be. God will show off his power, his glory, his majesty, especially when he's challenged. I love seeing Dagon on his face with his head and hands cut off. That God said, "Who do you think you are? There's only one God. Only one God. And that's our God." And this is cool stuff. I love the way God just speaks to the animals. These cows, against their will, did exactly what he told them to. Ended up slaughtered for it, but he did exactly what he told them to. All them mice, God just commanded, all them mice start swarming into the Philistines. God does that. Remember when Christ told Peter they needed tax money, catch a fish. Where do you think that fish got that coin? Or when Peter threw his net overboard after fishing all night. Who commanded those fish? How'd that happen? Jesus said, get in there. And by the hundreds and hundreds, they jumped into his nets. Because he's God. They listen to him. They have to. That's our God. That's the God we serve. I love this stuff. Paul, would you close in prayer, please?